hospital was so unlike her. There was a well of emotion bursting below her flat words, but she wouldn't let any of it out. Except once. When she was talking about the day Lottie died, when Zuran recognized her. She said she hadn't got to do what she wanted and die. She refused to repeat it. She refused to discuss the day again. But I never forgot what I heard. He stopped as if he was winded, his hands stilled, his body stiffened. It was clear that this time he did not intend to go on. Lisa's agony hung between them. Karen's head was hammering. She wanted to leave and never see Michael again, to never hear another word of her mother's terrible story, but there was still a gap, another bit of the jigsaw still out of her reach. Her mouth was as dry as if it was coated with sand, but she couldn't risk asking for water and giving Michael a chance to remove himself from the room. My mother wanted to die in the camp, and she wanted to die at the station, and something, including my father, kept getting in the way. Is that why she was angry with him? Michael remained silent, his face too tight to read. Why is there always something missing? She must have got better. She didn't try to kill herself again then, or not so that you've said, so she can't have stayed like that, angry with him for stopping her, not wanting to live. Please, Michael, that wouldn't make sense. If she had continued like that, surely she would have killed herself sooner, or she wouldn't have married him. When Michael answered, all the emotion had leached from his voice. He could have been discussing a stranger. What she did or didn't do, and how they were together, is not for me to say. Karen didn't need Marcus to translate that. But you know. You were in their wedding photo. You stayed in their lives. You told me that you loved her, that she loved you. My father rescued her, and she didn't want him to. That's what you've said. So what happened next? If she grew to love him, you would have said so. You haven't. And yet she stayed alive, and she married him, and moved to a country she didn't belong in, a country where no German would get an easy ride. Why? What changed? Her voice was shrill enough to bring Marcus to the arm of her chair. It made no impression on Michael. He had stiffened back into the man with a firm handshake and equally firm boundaries. Your mother had suffered a terrible loss. She struggled to get over it. Your father loved your mother and went to great lengths to protect her. Those things I know. As to their marriage and what led up to it, that is not my story to tell.
Please, Michael, help me understand this.
He brushed her distress away. I have told you what I am able to. If you believe there is more, that is between you and your father. You must talk to him.
Don't you think I've tried? Do you think I'd be here if he would talk back?
Michael got to his feet so briskly, Karen lost the thread of her argument. This has not been an easy conversation for either of us, but I hope it has helped. If you ever return to Berlin, perhaps we can meet under happier circumstances. He sounded like he had memorized a script. Karen gaped at him as he motioned her up and directed her to the door. Goodbye, Fräulein Cartwright. Please remember me to your father. It is growing late. It is time I retired for the night. Marcus will see you out. Karen was through the flat and out in the hallway. The front door clicked shut before she could gather her breath.
What just happened?
He managed you. Marcus leaned against the wall and reached into his pocket for his cigarettes. He's a master at it. He offered Karen the packet. She took one, but couldn't hold her hand steady enough to light it. I guessed he would be careful, and I was right. He knew exactly how much he was prepared to give, and when you managed to get too close, and he realized he'd slipped over his lines,
He closed you down.
Karen waited while Marcus struck another match and took a deep drag on her cigarette. She was out of practice. The nicotine made her head swirl.
I didn't imagine it, did I? There were things he said that pointed to something else happening after Lottie's murder. Something that made my mother marry a man who, at one point at least, she didn't seem to like very much.
No, you didn't imagine it.
Karen dropped the cigarette and ground it furiously into the wooden flooring.
So what do I do? I leave tomorrow evening.
There's nothing here that will open my father up. I'll tell him I know about Lottie, and he'll say I've heard everything, but I haven't. This time, when her voice rose, Marcus pulled her into his arms. Her head dropped onto his shoulder. She was almost sure she felt his lips on her hair.
This would be easier.
Sleep with Marcus and forget all the rest. Go home with a nice memory and move on. She looked up at him. There was such kindness in his face. And more. If she kissed him, she knew exactly how the night would go.
I can't.
She stepped back, slipped out of his embrace.
I want to, but I can't. I need to go back in there, Marcus. I need to try again.
It was a moment before he answered.
I know. But he won't open up again to you. Not tonight.
Then what do I do?
Let me try.
Karen was about to refuse, but he wouldn't let her jump in.
But I'm not taking over. I'm not pushing you away. But maybe, on my own, I can drag something else out of him. Will you trust me?
Trust. The hardest of feelings. And she didn't need to think before she answered. She took his arm and went down the street, let him call her a taxi. When she got back to the hotel, she crawled into bed exhausted, expecting to lie there picking over every word and every nuance of the night's half-revelations. She closed her eyes, waiting for the lake and Lisa's shocked face to slide in, waiting for Lottie's terrified cry. Instead, she saw Marcus, felt the warmth of his arms like an anchor. The world steadied itself a little. She slept without dreaming, until morning.
Last night didn't go the way that we hoped, then?
Marcus didn't need to answer. His face was as crumpled as his shirt. His eyes were puckered. Karen looped her arm through his and led him into the dining room.
Get some food into you and then you can tell me.
She fetched warm rolls from the buffet and ordered strong coffee.
Have you slept at all?
I'm not sure.
Marcus slathered honey on the bread and devoured it in two bites.
I think I dozed against the wall in the corridor while I was waiting for him to go to sleep. And then I got home and I was too wound up to try.
He didn't seem to notice he wasn't making sense. Karen waited while the waiter poured their coffee. Marcus drank that without noticing either.
I'm not following you. Maybe you need to start at the beginning? What happened when you went back up to the flat?
We fought. My father is a stubborn, impossible man, and I am an ungrateful son. That was the outcome, although the saying took longer.
Karen pushed her plate away, her appetite gone.
I'm sorry. Sorting out my family wasn't meant to drive the two of you apart.
Marcus sighed.
It didn't. This is nothing that hasn't been said before, or won't be said again, and it always starts the same way. With something personal that gets knocked down by his political dogma. The state has given you a good life, so be glad of it. The state doesn't dig up the past because to do so is indulgent, not productive. Your duty is to respect that. On and on like a record on repeat. I love him, and I admire him, I really do. But the man is a dinosaur. If it was up to him, the DDR would have swallowed up the West, not the other way round. He thinks our lives under the old regime were ordered, I think they were narrowed down to nothing. We love each other deeply, but it's not a gap we can close.
Karen saw the pain on his face and knew, no matter what he said, that she was responsible for part of it. There were as many layers in his life as there were in hers, although she suspected his growing up had been a far more complex thing to navigate.
You never considered leaving? I don't mean escaping. I mean applying to go to the other side.
People did. We saw the reports when it happened. Marcus closed his eyes. For a moment she thought he was annoyed at the question, then he looked at her with his soft smile, and she realized he was simply trying to frame his answer in a way that wouldn't make her feel stupid.
I imagine those reports made that type of legal crossing over sound easy. It wasn't. It was just as dangerous as crawling through a tunnel or leaping over the wall. Choices weren't simple here, Karen. Everything had two faces. Applying to leave meant rejecting the East. A conscious decision that left your card literally marked. The minute anyone raised a request, the state closed its doors. No university, no decent job, no health care. For the one applying, and for the rest of their family. And 9 times out of 10, the application would be rejected. Then, unless you preferred to be sent to prison on some trumped-up and unanswerable charge, the only work available would be what the government you had turned your back on was gracious enough to provide. Working for the state was the end for too many good people. They were turned into spies to keep feeding the system.
So you felt you had no choice but to stay, especially given Michael's position.
Exactly. If I'd tried to leave, I would have broken Father's heart and ruined his life, never mind mine. My wanting out would equal his failure. So I never really considered it. Being a good son mattered to me more, although he doesn't believe that at the moment.
When she reached out her hand, he hung on to it. What happened last night, Marcus?
I tried to reason with him, to get him to understand that what happened to Lisa is still causing damage, that you had a right to know, and he had an obligation to tell. I wasted my breath. He thinks this constant talking is a Western disease. So I lost my temper. Also, a waste of breath. Never argue with a man who's spent 60 years soaked in communism. I swear, he could win a debate against death. Anyway, I got nowhere. He asked me to leave, and I went.
Karen rolled the crumbs on her plate into a ball and refused to give in to tears.
You tried.
I'm grateful. You've done more for me than you needed to, and I know more than I did when I came. Lottie's death was reason enough for my mother killing herself, whatever else did or didn't happen. People marry for all sorts of reasons. Who knows what really causes anyone to commit suicide? Maybe it's time to accept that I can't find answers that don't want to be found.
Karen, look at me.
When she did, he brushed away the tears that had escaped her furious blinking.
That's a brave face. But you don't believe what you're saying. And neither do I. Which is why I went back.
He reached into his jacket and took out 2 folded pieces of paper. What are those?
Newspaper articles. From my father's clippings file. Michael is a record keeper. He grinned as she frowned. Not in a bad way. He's no Stasi recruit, although I am sure they would have loved to have snared him. I told you I didn't know much about his past. Like you with Lisa, I've had to piece it together from snippets. I do know that he was captured at the end of the war when the Russians sacked Berlin, and he survived that because he was Jewish and because he could speak their language. And then, of course, because he told them he was a communist and had worked for the resistance. He made it through, A lot of his comrades weren't so lucky. They died or stayed missing. What I'd forgotten, until you came, was that Father kept looking for them, and kept records of anything that might turn into a lead. He was always cutting things out of the newspapers, trial reports and police discoveries. So, last night, I waited till he was sure to be asleep. And then I let myself back in and went through his papers. Marcus held out the yellowing scraps. What can I say? You finally turned me into a spy and therefore a good DDR citizen. Although, I'm not sure I'll be boasting about that anytime soon. Anyway, these were all I could find for the time between your mother's return and her wedding. It's not as much as I hoped. Perhaps he wasn't so systematic with his records then.
Karen smoothed the brittle papers out. The oldest of the two was dated 2nd of December 1946. It was short, barely a handful of lines, and reported the disappearance of Commandant Fritz Surin from his Hamburg cell only days before the Ravensbrück war crimes trial was due to start. Surin's name was thickly underlined. Karen read it through and didn't know what to make of it. Do you think Michael was following the trial? Or Zurin's escape, at least, because of Lisa? When he was talking, he kept mentioning protecting her, hinting at the lengths that he and Andrew went to. Do you think they were trying to find Zurin? To bring him to justice? Marcus waved for more coffee.
Maybe. That crossed my mind. But it's an odd pairing to go Nazi hunting. A British soldier and a German communist.
Karen waited until the waitress had gone again, her mind whirring. Perhaps it's not as unlikely as it sounds. My father was in the Royal Military Police, and Michael wasn't short on connections. The more she looked at the underlined words, the quicker the storyline started building. And we know my father liked to play the knight in shining armor where my mother was concerned. Maybe finding Zurin was some kind of offering. Or maybe they hoped Zurin would give evidence at the trial about the soldier who killed Lottie. He must have been there. If what Michael said about him pulling Lisa out from the other women right after it happened was true, he would have known who the man was. Surely even in that place such a brutal act would have stood out. They could have been hoping to identify the killer and get justice. It actually makes sense when you think about it.
Karen picked up the other cutting, scanning it quickly for a link to Ravensbrück, or the quest she could suddenly see their father's undertaking.
Then she read it again more slowly. The disappointment was the same. I don't see what this one has got to do with the other. The second article, dating from February 1947, was longer. A plea from the Berlin police for help with identifying a body which had been recovered from the River Spree. Karen read the details aloud, hoping Marcus might stop her when she reached the connection. The woman's body, which was dislodged from a patch of reeds when the river thawed, was wrapped in sacking and weighed down with a large stone. Preliminary identification has been hampered by what the Berlin police refer to as substantial facial injuries. A post-mortem is scheduled for next week. It is hoped this will help establish the exact cause of death and furnish some clues to the victim's identity. The victim was well-dressed and wearing a wedding ring. Providing useful information in this case may lead to a reward. She stopped and waited, but Marcus said nothing.
I don't get it. I'm sorry. What has this got to do with the Ravensbrück trial or my mother? Unless something had happened, maybe my mother had gone missing. Do you think that might be it? She had disappeared and Michael thought the body was hers?
She was in danger of crumpling the paper. Marcus took the articles back and folded them carefully into an envelope.
That's possible. Or, perhaps, given the trial was coming and all kinds of secrets might have been about to spill out, he thought it was another prisoner from Ravensbrück who had been disposed of and he wanted to prepare her or keep her safe. I've no more clue to how these are connected than you. Or even if they are. But whether there's a link or not, I think you should take them back to England. Show them to your father and see where, if anywhere, that leads. In the meantime, I'll do some digging. See if the newspaper the second one came from still exists and has archives. It's not much, but surely it's something new to push Andrew with. Karen wasn't convinced, but she put the envelope into her bag. What if Michael notices they're missing? For the first time since he arrived at the hotel, Marcus smiled. Then we'll know that they matter. The dining room had emptied while they were talking. Theirs was the last table waiting to be cleared. Karen checked her watch. 10 o'clock. She had hours before her flight. The trip had been exhausting. The demands of new clients and old mysteries had drained her. She felt old, lost in other people's emotions. She glanced over at Marcus, at the face which was as kind as it was handsome. His feelings hadn't seemed important to her when she first arrived. That wasn't true anymore. There was a connection between them she knew she hadn't imagined. Something good could come out of this, if she was brave enough to try.
Would you like to be just Marcus and Karen for the day?
He sat back, watching her carefully.
Explain.
Two people who've recently met, who find each other interesting, who've had enough of the past and not enough of the present. He grinned.
Who live in the West and have never heard of the East, who listen to music some people might call decadent, who spend money without thinking on frivolous things, and kiss in the street without caring.
If you like. He jumped up, grabbed her hand.
I like it, Karen Cartwright. I really, really like it.
This time, when he pulled her into his arms and kissed her, she didn't hesitate. He looks happy, and even better than the nurses said. There was a croquet match in progress on the lawn behind the mountebank, and Andrew was in the thick of it, laughing at a misplaced shot, bowing in mock deference to a more skillful player. Perhaps this is who he is when I'm not around. Popular. Carefree. It was a sobering thought. Someone must have spotted her, alerted him. Andrew turned to the edge of the lawn, where Karen was hovering, and put down his mallet. Karen waved, and was saddened, but not surprised, when he hesitated and took his time walking over.
I stayed away because everyone seemed to think that was for the best, but I've been keeping up with your progress. You look even better than I thought you would.
You look really well. She meant it. In the nearly 2 months since she had seen him, the hollows in his cheeks had plumped out and his face had recaptured its color.
I know you have. Thank you. And yes, I tire quicker than I would like and I need to take care, but the doctor is happy with my progress. I have my own flat in the complex now. It's very pleasant.
He paused, but not long enough for her to speak.
I trust your visit to Berlin was what you hoped it would be.
His eyes were wary, his manner formal. She sensed he would wave her goodbye if she let him. Karen took a steadying breath. This could not come out rushed and garbled.
I'm sorry. For everything.
For not being kinder.
For the things I accused you of.
For not being a better daughter. Andrew took a step back, ran his hand through his hair. Karen didn't know what else to do but keep going.
I thought you were trying to control her.
I know now you were trying to protect her.
I should have trusted you more.
There was a carved wooden bench a few feet away. He sat down heavily on it. To Karen's relief, he left space for her to join him.
You found Michael, then?
She nodded.
You know about Lottie?
When she nodded again, he sank back against the slats and closed his eyes. Karen started to panic.
Are you all right? Oh, no, is it your heart again?
I just need a moment.
Karen was half off the seat to get help, when she felt his hand on her arm. He straightened up, but didn't move it. Karen sat as still as if a butterfly had found her.
What else did he tell you?
Not much. He said you found Mother at a train station on her way back from the concentration camp. That you took her to hospital. That you... Michael said you developed a crush on her. Her father smiled. That makes us sound like teenagers. I suppose, in a way, we were. 6 years of war took our youth away. I was, what, in 1945, 29? It sounds old enough to have had plenty of girlfriends, but I hadn't. I certainly had never met anyone as lovely as your mother. And I was a romantic, casting myself as a knight in shining armor. Not that she ever asked me to. I think, if I'm honest, which I was less inclined to be then, she hated that I saw her that way, as someone who needed rescuing. It certainly wasn't how she saw herself. Sometimes, I pushed her too far and her eyes would flare. I liked that sparky side of her. His cheeks were wet. Karen forced herself not to look at him. But she had suffered terribly. She wouldn't tell me much herself, but she had experienced things that went beyond my comprehension. I knew of the camps. We all did by then, but I'd never been in one. And what happened to her daughter? He sighed and shook his head in a way that reminded Karen of Michael restructuring himself. I should have told you about Lottie when you were old enough not to be frightened. I'm sorry. At least now you know why she did what she did. You know the whole story. But I don't, do I? His hand withdrew. Karen inched forward as cautiously as if she were sliding over newly set ice. There are gaps. I can feel them.
I don't know what Michael's been telling you, but this was all a long time ago. His memories are no doubt hazy.
He had shifted away. She could feel him poised to get up. He didn't tell me, that's the point. Michael was really careful. He didn't want to talk about you and her. He said it wasn't his place. But he let one thing slip. He said when he came to the hospital, Mother was angry. Not with him. He said she felt nothing for him, but with you. He wouldn't explain why or how that changed and how you ended up getting married. Because there was nothing to explain. When Andrew did scramble up, Karen was ready for him.
Don't, Dad. Please.
Her unexpected softness, and the use of a term she'd barely even used as an infant, pulled him back down faster than her hand.
I swear, I don't want to hurt you.
I've done enough of that.
If you tell me I've got this wrong, that Mother's suicide was solely because of Lottie, and the agony from that she understandably couldn't shake, that she married you for love, and there are no more secrets. I'll believe you. I promise.
Karen let her hand drop, stopped talking, gave him the moment to leave. When he didn't take it, when he sat still again, she took the cuttings out of her bag.
Would you look at these for me?
Michael kept them. We, his son, Marcus, and I, thought they might be important.
He's a good man, Michael's son. He's trying very hard to help all of us through this.
Andrew nodded, although Karen could see he was reluctant. She handed him the piece about Zurin's escape first, and waited while he read it.
We wondered, Marcus and I, if you were trying to find Zurin and get justice for Mother.
He passed it back with a shrug, and a look Karen could only read as relief. I was never that fanciful. Michael may have considered it. He had a network of connections I wasn't privy to, but he never mentioned it to me, Anyway, the French got Zurin in the end, hanged him in 1950. I've no idea about Michael's motives, but this means nothing to me. I avoided the trial and tried to keep any mention of it away from your mother. Revisiting what happened there would have done her no good. I'm sorry, but whatever this is, I can't help you with it. His response was disappointing, but Karen had had enough experience of her father evading her to know when he was telling the truth.
Fair enough. But what about this one?
When Andrew read the second article, the change was immediate. There was no relief. His tight edges dissolved as if he could no longer hold himself together. He shoved the cutting back at her as if the words were written in acid. Why on earth would he have kept this? Karen, please. I can't. Pain furrowed his face. It twisted Karen's stomach to see him so haunted that the crack she had been searching for had finally appeared, and she had no choice except to force it wide open.
Did you think the body was Mother? Had she read about the trial and run away and you were afraid that someone had hurt her? Were the camp survivors in some kind of danger? Was that why Michael had this?
Christ, no. It was nothing like that. He was shivering.
I could make him ill again. I should stop.
She knew that she couldn't.
Then what was it? Why was some drowned woman important? Was it a friend of Mother's? Someone she was in the camp with? Were you scared what she might do if she found out?
Michael said more than once that you were desperate to protect her. A friend? He made a noise that could have been a laugh or a sob. You're not going to give up, are you? Then yes, I was desperate to protect her. We both were. And yes, it was someone from the camp. Oh, Karen, my darling. You don't get it. How could you? Ravensbrück was a women's camp. All the guards there were female. Her father, the soldier playing the knight in shining armor. Michael, with heaven only knows what training behind him. Karen stared at her father as if she had never seen him before.
It was the guard in the river.
The one who murdered Lottie. You and Michael killed her. Andrew raised his head and stared back at his daughter. His face was as white as a corpse.
Chapter 15. Lisa. Berlin, November 1946 to April 1947. The shop was quiet. The frost-laced November wind had pushed the pedestrians back to their firesides, ready for a tucked-in Friday night. Herr and Frau Herber had already left, gone to visit their daughter in the countryside to stock up on the butter and cheese that kept them both round. Lisa was glad of the respite. The shop and its adjoining workroom was a simpler place without them. The Herbers were good, generous people, but they were also gossips and inquisitive, and sometimes the balance tipped too far the wrong way. She glanced at her watch. 5 o'clock and dark as night outside. There was only one more order to prepare, ready for making up on Monday. Then she could close and slip away before either of her usual escorts had a chance to appear. She was too tired tonight to be much use as company. Lisa stretched the fabric along the cutting desk and marked off the lengths with tailor's chalk. She could lose herself for hours like this, even when her eyes and shoulders were drooping. That much at least hadn't changed. Even through her time as Zurin's seamstress, the process of assembling the building blocks of a dress had never lost its capacity to absorb and calm her, had never lost its magic. Carving straight lengths of material into intricate pieces, turning them from flat to full, so that the finished garment would cling and swing and transform even the thinnest body. It remained magic. Because this is theatre. Although that wasn't strictly true anymore. Or at least,
not in the way her father once meant. Lisa traced the pattern onto the cloth, struggling to picture Paul spinning his spells in Berlin's newly revived but battered and shortage-hampered fashion industry. There was little in it he would recognize, or that she could imagine him wanting to be part of. None of the names who once ruled it had come back from the exile or the hell they'd been sent to. The extravagant dresses House Elfman was once famous for were museum pieces. The shows they put on, a myth. Despite the extravagant promises made by the morale-boosting magazines, silk and taffeta and crepe de chine had become the stuff of dreams, along with unlimited flowers and perfume-thick air and spectacle. Post-war Berlin was a divided city, hacked into four political sectors in 1945 by the victorious Allied powers and into two sharper, more obvious divisions by money, or, more accurately, the lack of it. The poor, a rapidly growing class, were hungry and cold. They were stuck in queues, surviving from day to day on scraps of food and scraps of coal, with no sense that the war they had lost had ended. The rich, however, who had salted their fortunes carefully away and were bolstered now by the flood of Americans and their dollars into the city, had re-embraced the social whirl. Parties lit up embassies and refurbished hotels. Partygoers chased glamour from any fashion house that could get back on its feet and supply it. Competition was cutthroat. Customers were fickle. Resources were limited and ingenuity prized. The last days of House Elfman, which had demanded a creativity from Lisa that the old-style designers would have found horrifying, had proved to be of more value than any lessons in haute couture she had learned. In the year since she had secured a job at the Herber's dressmaking shop, Lisa had retrained her hands and eyes to learn the language of new materials. Slippery acetates that ran away from the needle, wool mixtures that were too cardboard stiff to fold and tuck. She had also learned to adapt her designs. Dresses no longer came elaborately sculpted with knife-edge pleats and intricate gathers. There weren't the supplies to create them. Women with new responsibilities and less certainties in their worlds no longer needed morning dresses and afternoon dresses and a week's worth of evening ensembles. Except for the wealthiest, the days of excess had gone. Lisa didn't mourn them. The Herbers, however, did, and their ambitions far outweighed the little shop that had fallen into their hands when the war had left it ownerless. It took Lisa less than a week to realize that, despite their pretensions, the Herbers were struggling and the shop's existence was threatened. Glad of something to do that filled her days and asked nothing of her but her skills, Lisa had risen to the challenge. She plundered their dwindling fabric stores and spliced together mismatched fabric ends, whipping up skirts and blouses in what some might call patchwork, but she described as rainbow arc outfits. She encouraged Herr Herber to open up the gloomy store window and filled its space with colour. Women, tired of grey and bored with narrow skirts that hobbled their knees, began to find their way to Budapester Straße. Lisa watched as they sighed in front of the mirrors and ran hands down bodies that rationing had turned boyish. She worked off-cuts into overskirts nipped in with sashes and bulked out with padding that restored war-starved hips and waists, and used inserts and darts to create blouses stiff with the illusion of volume. Women left the shop feeling like women. Herr Herber saw the order book fill and began to introduce Lisa as Rumpelstiltskin, daring clients to bring in any fabric they could salvage for darling Frau Ettinger, who truly can weave gold out of straw. Why does he call you that? Surely he knows your name is Elfman.
No, he doesn't. Why would I use a Jewish name if I don't have to?
Germany was beaten. That's not the same as safe. It was a clever answer to Andrew's confused question, but it wasn't the truth. Lisa wasn't afraid of being Jewish. She wasn't afraid of anything anymore, except memories. She could be Elfman anywhere else, but not in the dressmakers. Saying her parents' name there was impossible. Either no one would know it in this business where everyone should, or, worse, it would be recognized. Some well-meaning soul would reveal the unthinkable and fill out that last image Lisa held of Paul and Margarita walking away with a camp name and a too-detailed nightmare. So, at work, she was Ettinger. Andrew accepted her reason, as she had known that he would. He was too horrified by the whole business of the camps not to. She wished she could so easily stop the rest of his questions. Now that she was no longer in the hospital and seemed more sure of herself, he was desperate to burrow into her history, to know every detail about her family, about her life before, about the dreams she had dreamed there. "So I can get to know you better." As if the Lisa then and the Lisa now were the same person.
"He means well. He cares about you. They both do."
She picked up her scissors as her conscience pricked. Michael and Andrew. 1.5 years out of hospital, and she still hadn't shaken the pair of them off. The truth was, she didn't want to. Somewhere along the way, their concern for her had stopped being a burden, and she had learned to value them both, despite, or perhaps because of, how different the two men were. Andrew was the simpler of the two, and his company was impossible not to enjoy. He was well-read, he had an eye for art that she appreciated, and a way of approaching the world without judgment that carried a genuine warmth. They had fallen into the habit of walking together at the weekends, watching Berlin reshaping, sometimes talking, sometimes not, or sitting in one of the dozens of cinemas that had popped back up, both happy to be lost in other people's stories. Lisa had come to like Andrew very much. She knew he had fallen in love with her. In a different world, it wasn't impossible that she could have fallen in love with him. He was good and kind and patient. Lisa knew that he would do everything in his power to make her happy. And he would be very easy to make happy in return. He knew that she was broken, that she had far less to give than he deserved, and it didn't matter to him. What was it he had said? "You like me. I know you do. And you trust me." That could be enough, if you let it, to make into a good life. "I have love enough for both of us now. One day, if you let yourself, you might just catch me up." From anyone else, that would have sounded needy or weak. Coming from Andrew, somehow it didn't. And that was the problem. He was such an honorable man. He deserved so much more than a woman who couldn't work out why she was still living. As for Michael, he was in love with her too, and that was far harder to ignore. There was such a wealth of history between them, good and bad. Lisa had tried to push him away, but he kept coming back. She couldn't pretend anymore that he meant nothing to her. Sometimes she thought she sought out Andrew's company the most because she couldn't trust herself to be alone too long with Michael. He had a way of looking at her that went straight through to her heart. But her heart was still too broken to find room for that. A wave of exhaustion washed over her, the way it so often did when she tried to puzzle out her future. She put down her scissors and ran her hand over the blue wool she had already cut, noticing as she did so that it was the same deep shade the doctor had worn under his white coat on the day he had discharged her. "You're well enough to leave us, and we need the bed." It was the last days of Ravensbrück's liberation all over again. She would have argued, if she thought for a moment, he would have listened to her any more than the American doctors had then. Or, if she had had anything better to say than, "I don't want to leave here. I can't deal with the world." Nobody could deal with the world the war had left them with, and she was a picture of health compared to most of the wretches the hospital admitted. The doctor knew what had happened to her. There was nothing he could offer to heal that wound but pity.
Lisa didn't want that from him. She didn't want that from anyone. All pity did was stoke the anger that still crouched in her stomach. So much rage constantly churning inside her. Lisa stared at the desk, at her scissors and pins neatly waiting, and wondered why, when it reared, she didn't glow red or burn everything she touched. Andrew couldn't see it, or chose not to see it, but Michael could. That was the danger with Michael. He saw everything she was, and didn't hide from telling her.
Maybe the anger is good. Maybe it's what keeps you going.
As if she wanted to keep going.
Then why do you? Why don't you end it like you planned?
Up it popped again, the question she could never quite answer, that always wriggled on into,
it doesn't need to be the lake. There's cars to walk under. There's scissors to cut wrists with. There's a dozen ways.
It was 2 years since she had last kept her vigil over the water, joining Lottie, her only goal. 2 years since she had swayed on the train platform, and yet here she was, still living her life. Something was pushing her to keep on breathing, but try as she might, she couldn't work out what. When the hospital had discharged her, Michael and Andrew were there waiting to take over. She wouldn't let them. She had allowed Michael to use his connections and help her find a place to live, but had refused to move into his block. She had waved Andrew away when he worried that she was too weak yet to find work. She had hauled herself off to the new tailoring quarter springing up round the Kufvrstendamm and sold her talents to the Herbers with far greater success than she had managed with the wartime businesses who had chased her away. She had carved out a life, and she was still itching into it. She still didn't understand why living it mattered.
For Andrew and Michael, perhaps?
It was part of the answer, but it couldn't be all of it. No matter how much she valued their affection, no matter that she knew the love they wrapped her in was more than so many people had. Post-war Berlin was a battered place. Its heart pounded by bombs, its streets crammed with the lonely and the desperate. Lisa passed them as she walked between her new home in Seydlitzstrasse and the Budapesterstrasse shop. Starving children, whose feet were bound in blanket strips, whatever the weather, whose faces were sharpened like weasels. Lines of rag-bundled women clearing rubble from Berlin's ravaged buildings, from around the cellars, too many still lived in. Women too hungry to manage such physically punishing, pitifully paid work, too hungry not to. With no one left to love or be loved by. Women who would have envied Lisa's life as much as the wretches stuck in the camp that Zurin snatched her away from. Lisa knew how lucky she was, but it was hard to feel grateful when she was so filled with guilt.
Excuse me, are you open?
She had been so engrossed in picking over her life, she hadn't heard the bell ring. If Herr Herber found that out, his pale face would turn purple. Lisa straightened herself up and smiled at the dark shape, letting the cold in.
Yes, for another half hour.
Never hurry a customer, my dear. There's not enough wealth in the city for us to rest on our laurels. Frau Herber's lesson chimed louder than the doorbell had.
And longer, of course, if you need it.
The woman came further in, shaking frosty raindrops all over the floor.
Perfect. It will be weeks before I'm in the city again, and I wanted to see about placing an order.
She waved her sodden umbrella at Lisa and didn't offer any thanks when Lisa took it.
It's such tremendous luck that I found you. There I was, treating myself to a cake in the sweetest cafe on the Kufvrstendamm, and in walks a woman in the most darling ruby-red coat. Of course, I had to ask her where she got it, and she naturally was quite thrilled that I did. And then, to find out that the dressmaker who made it is only 5 minutes away, and my dear Henke, so desperate for me to have something special for the winter. Well, this was clearly meant to be. On and on she went, in a tone her breathy delivery clearly intended to be charming, but that hit all the wrong stresses. Lisa was barely listening. She had struggled to listen to a single word since the woman had stepped from the threshold into the shop's buttery light. Her throat was so tight, she couldn't have spoken even if the woman had wanted her to. All she could think was, how can she look so ordinary? The clothes were different. The coat the woman wore was loden green and lumpily belted rather than a flowing black cape. Her hat had a feather set at its center, not a swastika pin. But nothing about the heavy figure had changed in 4 years. The square-chinned face still glowed with health, the cheeks turned as ruddy by the November wind as they had been that long ago and yet so recent bitter February. The eyes, for all the effort made to widen them with pencil flicks, still sank like currants into the doughy skin. The hair was smartly rolled and not so tightly drawn back, but it was just as brassily blonde as the strands that had once poked out from under the sharply peaked cap. She was a first-class Aryan poster girl, even out of uniform, and every inch of her face and form had been photographed in a moment 3 years ago and printed on Lisa's memory ever since. Lisa couldn't speak. She could barely breathe. But the guard carried on, oblivious. And I do so need a new coat, a properly tailored one. I love my babies, I truly do, but... She patted her middle with a sickeningly coy smile. Well, they've hardly been kind to my waistline. Babies? The word splintered as it fell. The guard swelled with pride. Twins. Two girls, if you can believe it. Such a shock and such a handful. Both daddy's little darlings, of course. It would be a lot to manage for most people, but my Henke is such a good provider. He's the mayor of our town and so well-respected. Fürstenberg, that's where we live. It's an awfully pretty place, about an hour or so outside the city, although I doubt you will have heard of it. The town in the woods, near the lake. I've heard of it.
The guard was too delighted with herself to hear Lisa's voice shaking.
So, to business, how does this work? Do you have a pattern book, some ideas I could look at? The notion that Lisa could possibly do anything as normal as make this woman a coat was so preposterous, she found herself acting as she would with any other customer. She nodded and waved the woman to a chair placed next to a small table, gestured to the pile of magazines lying on it as if she was an actress playing a role so well-learned it didn't require her brain to take any part in it. Such a good selection. How perfect.
That word again. That expectation that the world would fall the exact way she required it, as it had clearly kept on doing for her, and no doubt all the others who had gripped hold of power with their dogs and their whips and walked away when the war was done, as if no part of the horror they presided over was any of their doing. Lisa had seen the reports of the Ravensbrück trial, despite Andrew and Michael's efforts to keep her away from them. The number of arrests was laughable. A handful of faces standing in for a mob. She moved a step closer, ran through the next set of lines.
Can I get you a tea or a coffee while you look through the designs?
The woman opened a magazine and began taking off her gloves.
Coffee would be delightful, as long as it's the real stuff. And you have sugar. She doesn't know me. I doubt she's ever seen me.
Lisa stood perfectly still, watching the leather unpeel from the skin, watching the white hands emerging. They were too big to be elegant, the right one too scarred to show off.
Scream, snap, splash.
Lisa didn't move. She hadn't expected to see anything other than that scar to emerge. She carried on quietly watching,
until the gloves were folded and stowed in the shiny black handbag, until the woman's attention was fixed on the models and their blank, haughty faces. There was no startling moment when she made a decision. There was no need to work out a plan or think through what she was doing. Every move that was needed was already known and had been set in motion when the door first opened. Now they unfolded, and Lisa felt them as much a part of her as her heart's steady beating. There was no voice in her head screaming, "Stop!" There was no voice in her head except, "This is punishment pure and simple." This act, Lisa now knew was coming, was as much a mother's job as her lake-watching vigil had been. "This is what has been keeping me alive." The realization ran through her like a charge and made the rest simple. 4 paces to the cutting desk, 4 paces back. All the stored fury turning to fuel. Now it had finally found its purpose.
"Here you are. My, aren't you quick?"
It was surprisingly easy and surprisingly silent. The blonde head lifted. The black eyes went searching for their sugary treat. If the guard saw what was coming, she didn't have time to react. 1 swift move, scissors up, scissors down, glinting blades finding their own path from fleshy lobe to sinewy throat. A red scarf springing into the air, flying out in a curve as if caught by a breeze, and then dropping, pooling back round the limp neck. The body slumped, eyes wide, eyes closed. All over in seconds.
"Where are the keys, Lisa? Look at me. Where are the door keys?"
The shop was in shadow, the window blinds pulled down, although Lisa didn't remember drawing them. Time must have ticked on quicker than she thought because Andrew was here, waiting, she assumed, to walk her home, to offer her dinner. He was standing closer than he normally would, and his face was so colourless she wondered if he was ill.
"Why don't you give those to me, and then tell me where the keys are? It would be best for everyone if I could lock the door."
That made sense. It was obviously getting late and no one else would come in on such an unpleasant night. And the scissors, which she hadn't realized she was still holding, were slippery and sticky. She looked down at them. Why were they in such a mess?
"Lisa!"
She dropped the blood-soaked blades, whirled round. The guard was still sitting in the chair. Her coat had stiffened and smelled metallic, and a stain had spread out like an ink blot under her chair.
"What have I done?"
Lisa remembered the door opening, the woman coming in as vividly as if it had just happened, and that terrible moment of recognition, and that voice talking, going on and on. The rest was a blur, a series of snapshots, some she desperately wanted to stay out of focus.
"Babies. Oh, dear God, she had babies."
Once she let the images spool back, they wouldn't stop coming.
"I've killed her. And she had babies. Unless, please God, she's not dead."
Lisa ran to the body, grabbed its wrist and began scrabbling for a pulse.
"Is it possible she's not dead?"
"No. No, it's not." Andrew pulled her away from the cold skin she was clutching. "Look at the blood, Lisa. No one could survive that." He was right. There was so much of it. On her, as well as on the body. Lisa sank onto her heels and stared at her scarlet-stained hands. The need to explain, to somehow make it right, overwhelmed her.
"It was the guard, the one who killed Lottie. She walked in like a customer wanting a coat. She didn't know me at all. I didn't think, I just did it. I've longed to do it. Dear God, I've longed for it all this time, I just didn't know."
She rubbed at her hands, but the blood wouldn't shift.
"And now it's done. And we have to call the police."
Andrew pulled her back to her feet with a roughness she didn't know he was capable of.
Are you crazy? We can't call them. Look at her. You can hardly say this was self-defense.
Why would I want to?
Because they'll hang you. And don't you dare tell me that's what you want. Don't you dare. Where are the keys?
What? His grip was so tight she could feel her arms bruising. Where are the keys, Lisa?
For the front door.
Let go of me and I'll get them.
He released her. She ran and grabbed them from the hook, gave them to Andrew, and turned back to the telephone. He pulled her away before she could lift the receiver.
Leave that. As soon as the door's locked, we need to clean this place up. And you?
No, I told you. We need to call the police. This is a crime. A terrible crime.
Andrew's eyes were so dark it was frightening.
And I've told you already we're not going to do that. Go and wash your hands while I tackle the floor.
He pushed her through the velvet curtain into the kitchen and grabbed a cloth and soap flakes.
Hurry up, and then fetch me some sturdy cloth and some string.
He was too wound up to argue with. Lisa scrubbed her hands until they were raw and then collected a pile of old potato sacks and a bundle of twine. When she came back into the shop, ready to stand up to him again, she was thankful to see he had come to his senses and was speaking on the telephone.
I'll tell them who she was. I'll explain what she did. Surely they'll understand.
He slammed down the receiver when he saw Lisa reappear and took the sacking she was holding out to him.
Thank you for making that call. I'm glad you could see there's no choice.
Lisa reached for his hand, but he shrugged her away.
There's always a choice. I wasn't calling the police. I was calling Michael. He has a van, and we need it.
Not Michael. Not standing witness to this.
Confessing her crime to the police suddenly seemed far less important than not having to confess it to Michael.
Andrew, no! Don't bring him into this, I'm begging you!
His face changed. His voice switched from fury to what sounded like fear.
Don't do this, Lisa! Don't make yourself into some kind of sacrifice. I can't live with that. Michael won't be able to live with that. Please. Please. If you have any care for me at all, just do what I say.
He looked so broken. So desperate. Whatever force had been pushing Lisa on since she picked up the scissors drained away.
She moved through the next moments doing only what he asked. Helping him roll the body onto the hessian, helping him pile the cleaning cloths on the guard's chest. But when the doorbell rang, she wouldn't let Andrew answer it, and she gave Michael barely a second to take the scene in. She needed to face him and face her actions before Andrew told a more edited story.
It's the guard who murdered Lottie. I cut her throat.
Michael stared at her. He opened his arms. All she wanted to do was fall into them. But Andrew grabbed him instead.
And if we don't sort this out, she's going to give herself up to the police and she's going to hang. So help me. Are you listening, Michael? Help me or she's lost.
Michael, no. Don't listen to him. Listen to me.
But Michael turned away from her and spoke only to Andrew.
I need something heavy. I need to destroy her face and make sure that nobody recognizes her.
He scanned the shop and picked up a sewing machine. Lisa darted forward.
That's wrong, that won't work.
She was about to explain, but both men rounded on her.
Don't look, if you can't stand it, but let us do what we must.
She was exhausted, her limbs trembling. Faced with Andrew and Michael not listening to her, so united and so determined to do what they clearly thought was in her best interests, it was easier to give in. To convince herself she could still somehow make this right later. She stood back. She made herself watch and not argue.
We need to take her to the river.
Their voices were so low she wasn't sure which of them spoke. Not that it mattered. Michael and Andrew were focused only on each other and the tightly bound package now balanced between them.
You don't understand.
You need to come with us. You can't stay here alone.
Neither of them were listening to her. It was clear they still thought she would call the police. They bundled the body and Lisa into the van
intent only on where they were going. "At least tell me where we're going."
"There's a point across from Schloss Charlottenburg, where the river quickens. The current should take the body down from there to the Havel and out to the wider waters. It's better to let the river move her than us."
Once Michael answered her, without turning round, neither man spoke to her or each other again, except when Andrew told Michael to slow down or risk being stopped by an army patrol. Once the American military jeep passed by, Berlinerstrasse stayed empty. There was no traffic to slow them on the Schlossbrücke or in the maze of broken streets that bordered the river. Lisa knew there was no point in speaking, that their actions had taken on their own momentum in the same way that hers had. When they drew close to the tightly packed tree line, Michael pulled the van in.
"It should be quiet enough here, as long as we move quickly. Anyone hanging around this place will be too drunk to know what they've seen, or be believed if they try to describe it."
He jumped out, followed by Andrew. They wrestled the body out of the back and told Lisa to wait. She couldn't. The light on the water spun too strong a pull. She followed them as they stumbled over the muddy ground, both men struggling to stay upright. It had rained for most of November, and the river was full, branches caught in it and tumbling.
"She won't lie as peacefully as Lottie."
"On my count. And on three,"
Michael's whisper swelled in the silence. The bundle rolled towards the water. There wasn't an arc this time. It was more of a plunge. And there wasn't a quicksilver splash, but a crash as the water opened. A greedy roar that ran through Lisa's bones and ripped away the silence that had been forced on her in the salon.
"This is all wrong. Why wouldn't you listen to me?"
She stopped and sucked in a breath that came out in a scream.
"How can I have been so stupid? All I had to do was lock the door and keep you away. This was my fight, not yours, and now you're messed up in it."
Michael and Andrew broke into a run and caught her between them as her legs slipped from under her.
"It doesn't matter. No one will find her. Look at the river. It will take her for miles, toss her to bits."
She pulled and pushed against them, but they wouldn't let her go.
"No, it won't. She won't lie peacefully. How can she? This won't end it. Don't you see? I've killed her, and this won't end it. She had babies. Children of her own. Two little girls. One more than what she took from me. She'll be found. She'll be identified, and you'll pay a price that was only ever mine."
She was long past a whisper. Her voice bounced round the trees like a trumpet calling.
"Lisa, take a breath. I destroyed her face. You know I did. No one will know her."
Michael's arm tightened round her shoulders as if his words were reassuring.
"No! That's what I was trying to tell you. You got it all wrong. It wasn't her face that mattered. It was her hand. The scar on her hand. That's how they'll know her and track her to Lottie and to me."
Michael's arm fell away.
"And now you two are in danger. Because of me. What I've done makes me as evil as her. It makes me worse."
She spun round and began stumbling her desperate way towards the water. Michael lunged forward to grab her. Lisa felt his hand catch at her sleeve, but she tugged too hard for him to hold her and left him floundering in the mud.
"Andrew, for the love of God, stop her! Let me go! You have to let me go! You have to let me make it right!"
She was quick, but Andrew was quicker. When he caught her, his grip was so tight she couldn't pull free.
"Make it right? Are you crazy? How does you ending up in the water make any of this right?"
He pinned her arms so tight she couldn't struggle.
"I won't let you, Lisa, I won't. I can't have done all this to watch you die.